Hello, everybody. Welcome aboard. This is Smiles Lewis, and you're tuned in to the Blue Rose Report live via Anomaly Radio, transmitting straight out of Austin, Texas, man. The belly of the beast, as some folks say. Tonight, we're going to have a very interesting discussion with a writer who's journeyed down many paths around the world and written on a number of subjects, both in the forms of nonfiction and fiction, on subjects as diverse as art, economics, parapolitics, aka conspiracy theory, and in the realms of art, some very interesting arenas dealing with revolutionary thought that I think I can learn a lot from. So, our guest tonight is Lynn Bracken. Lynn is the author of one of the first widely distributed books published in the United States, suggesting that the 9/11 attacks were an inside job. Shadow Government, 9/11, and State Terror, reviewed in The Village Voice, September 2002, presents the State Terror thesis that describes the event as an indirect defensive attack, developing the offensive-defensive theory of terrorism created by Guy Debord and Gianfranco Sanguinetti. Bracken is the author of the first biography in any language on Debord and has translated a book by Sanguinetti. The kamikaze-style attacks, according to Bracken, must always be seen in connection with the anthrax poisonous letters as interlocking stratagems by the established power designed to gain power, designed to gain more power, and as a pretext for going on the offensive. Bracken is also the author of A General Theory of Civil War and of a chronology of the strategy of tension in Italy in his book Arch Conspirator. Bracken is an active member of the National Press Club, a professional member of investigative reporters and editors, and a member in good standing of the Baltimore-Washington Newspaper Guild. Lynn, are you with us?
I am. Thanks for having me.
It's great to finally get to talk to you. I became aware of your foray into the realm of parapolitics, at least on a big scale, with your very early 2002 book, The Shadow Government, 9/11, and State Terror. And I'll never forget, in this weird post 9/11 reality, when the mainstream media, for the first time ever, used the term shadow government in their mainstream news broadcast, not as a phrase like conspiracy theorist that they used to deride parapolitical researchers, but as an out and out, this is what's, you know, there, that, you know, continuity of government is often called shadow government. I mean, I know Bill Moyers had covered it as such years ago, but That really stood out in my mind. So,
it's a tricky title because, of course, you know, we can't really say exactly who the shadow government is, right down from the top to the bottom. So it really probably wouldn't be my first pick of the title, but that's the one we ended up with. And what I set out to prove really in the beginning of the book was the state terrorist thesis, namely that states routinely use terrorism that way for their ends.
And to me, that seems the hardest thing to get most people to believe, even though you can provide them with historical examples of how states have used terror tactics to move the populace in a given direction, usually onto the offensive. People still, you know, they can go, yeah, well, that was the past. That's history. Modern politicians don't do that sort of thing. I guess, as so often is the case, I really want to start at the beginning with how you got interested in the subject. I mean, for some people, it's a logical, you know, you're young and you see injustice and you question authority, and it's as simple as that. For others, it takes years and decades before they some pivotal event, you know, wakes them up and calls them to action. Which camp would you describe yourself as originating from?
Well, I guess, you know, I was interested in terrorism in part from a personal experience. I was living in the American Embassy in Moscow back in 1979 when I became involved with a group of dissidents in Russia, and I would assume that they were legitimate dissidents. Now I look back on it, you know, that they may have been manipulated as well. And I ended up inadvertently helping a guy get into the American Embassy with a bomb strapped to his belly.
Holy mackerel.
And he was meeting a consular official. He was trying to get out of the country. This had all been prearranged. It wasn't something that, you know, was just a random thing. And he said, if you can't get me out of the country, then I'm going to blow myself up. And to make a long story short, he agreed eventually. Well, they cleared out all the people, so he wasn't threatening anyone else. And they had the Americans had managed to get him to agree to leave, but the case had been turned over to the Soviets, so he was shot by a Soviet marksman. And the bomb went off at the same time because it was tied to a string on his finger. So when the bullet hit him, he must have moved his hand to cover the wound, and then the bomb went off,
Oh my God.
what the speculation is. So I was following, terrorism, at age 18, from a first-hand experience, and at the same time I was reading AP and TASS wire services, and I would see that, okay, there was a lot of BS in the TASS, but there was also some BS in the AP, and things never, it seemed very difficult to get to the truth of anything. And in the course of my studies at the university, I started reading a little bit of, anarchist, well, anarchist tech, and that seemed to me to be a possible way out. And I guess I sensed that there must be a need for revolution. There must be a need to change this, this big monolith that we have created, the nation state and the corporate government and all that. And so I guess that's really what got me involved in this. And I turned that into a novel. And it's called Free Play. It's set in the time of Chernobyl now, and basically the suicide, it coincides with a nuclear physicist who's warning about the disasters of Chernobyl, because of course the real consequence of this economic machine that we've created is just the destruction of the planet. So that was sort of the origins, and I ended up getting involved with the Well, with some anarchist affinity groups and a lot of great people, and I was a member of the Wobblies, and I worked at a little anarchist bookstore up in Baltimore for a while, and we did some actions. We were a little bit of a part of this, anti-globalization effort. We helped with the protest up in it was in 2000 in Quebec, when they had the Free Trade Agreement with the Americas summit. When we did some of the preparatory work for that, I worked on the and editing of the documents that went out around that time, the anti-globalization documents. And I did my share of other activism. I would give my aphorisms against work to the Secretary of Labor on Labor Day, and give my neo-Cantillon conspiracy for the universal cancellation of debt to the bankers and the World Bank. And we wrote some graffiti in 2000, some during the time of the World Bank meetings. And so I felt that at that time, around 2000, 2001, we really had them on the ropes. Actually, the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, now I think of it, that was in early 2001, not 2000, up in Quebec. But we had them on the ropes, I think. I was in actually Riga, Latvia at the time that 9/11 took place. And when I think back on it now, it's kind of strange that this Israeli woman who was Latvian, but origin, but actually living in Israel, wanted to go out to lunch with me and kind of cornered me and wanted to talk to me. And of course, now that we know so much about Israeli art, I really wonder if she was an Israeli art student. But anyway, so I was there at the time, and what really strikes me is that we were doing this big anti-consumerist kind of, how can we, art exhibit throughout the city, where we'd have a tram and we would ride around and we'd bring people in and we'd show them films and talk about the problems with capital and consumerism, because at the time they didn't have a word for consumerism. And what really struck me is, I get to the point, is that I guess there was Naomi Klein had written a book, this No Logo, and what did they have on the cover of The Economist the week of 9/11? It was pro logo, and they had really mimicked the typeface and the colors of her book when they did this. So it was, if the economist feels compelled to have to respond to kind of criticism,
And actually, and respond in a way that is actually reminiscent of some of the situationist style, taking existing logos and taking existing works and reworking them.
So there was. So then, as 9/11 happened, I was a little bit preoccupied romantically in Latvia at the time, and I just looked at the buildings coming down, and I said, we're never going to really know what happened there, for a long time. And I got back to the United States, and I guess Bamford had published a book where they had the Northwood document in it. He,
right.
he discovered that at the time, and we were all looking at the Northwood thing, and we're going, "Holy crap! You know, we've got another big piece of evidence." And see, what I had done in my Arch Conspirator book, I had written a chronology of the strategy of tension in Italy, so I had followed very carefully the the whole Gladio, and so many, there were so many revelations, in fact, and a lot of this stuff that's never been translated into English made it into French. And so I was able to really look at some of these parliamentary inquests and judicial inquests and see what it had been turned up through the Gladio business. And so then when more and more anomalies came out about 9/11, people came to me and they said, "Hey, you know, you've studied this thing. You need to write a book about, you know, about 9/11. At first I said, no, we don't need to do that. We don't really know enough yet. And then I'll even say, at this late stage, we don't know exactly what happened, although I do think we have a very good idea, but we don't know precisely what happened in terms of, like, all the mechanics of how it was done. You know, there's rival theories, as you well know.
Sure.
So that's what happened, and I guess I could relay to you, kind of an interesting thing. As I was working on the book, I'm working at a newspaper and trying to keep my head down, and yet, my apartment is open when I come home, a couple days in a row. I could inadvertently leave my apartment unlocked, but fairly unlikely, that I would do it separately in a row. And then I probably would never do it. And then I got verbatim identical warnings, and one from a woman who worked at Frederick, not to, the warning was, be careful what you write. You can't write just anything. You're a very powerful man. Of course, I don't consider myself to be a very powerful man, but the fact that two people said the exact same thing, really meant that I was given a message.
Well, and I mean, you've written for publications such as the San Diego Union Tribune and Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory, and you had your own self-publishing career with zines like Extra File and London-based Principia Dialectica, and what's this other one? The Daily Report for Executives, published by the Bureau of National Affairs.
Well, that's my day job.
So you're very much in tune with that realm of deep politics, parapolitics. That's just publicly acknowledged in terms of foreign policy, I guess, analysis, that sort of thing. So you're much more respectable than, say, your average quote unquote conspiracy theorist. And as you've stressed, you're presenting this state terror thesis that isn't just something that you whipped up, but that is the concretization of past analysis of things like the strategy of tension in Italy and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's why I'm interested in you. I think you've got an important, unique perspective that's very well tempered between an acknowledgement of some of the darkest aspects of human social behavior in the form of covert ops, and yet it's rounded out with this artistic revolutionary thought that comes from very deep-rooted exploration of human social and artistic expression in the form of the Situationist, which I'm still barely getting my head around. So, and I think you're right. I think we, as many competing theories as there are about 9/11, it's really hard to know for sure what's the real story. And we'll get into some of the more specifics of that, some of the theories in just a minute. But can you describe a little more this, and it's an Arch Conspirator where you did the apples and the strategy of tension with some elements of the Situationist history?
No, that is in the 9/11 book. The Shadow Government book is where I go into that the most. I mean, I do it in Arch Conspirator as well. This is something that I've worked on for many years. And so, and having translated Sanguinetti, who really did it the most with his book, it was the theory of terrorism.
On terrorism in the state.
In the state, yeah. I'm sorry. I just came back from a full day of editing. I'm a little bit burned out here. But anyway, and so, I translated another book by Sanguinetti, but of course, I'd read the other one and pored over that very carefully. And I think that there were some gaps in what they had said, because what we found out is that, Sanguinetti tried to blame all of the terrorism on the police, the bombings and stuff that took place in the name of the Red Brigade, but were really carried out by elements of the state. And certainly police were involved, but now we know, of course, that it wasn't just them, that it was the the CIA and Israel was involved, and there was, you know, well, we know this Mario Moretti guy was making trips to and from the CIA headquarters in Europe, in Paris. And interesting enough, this guy Mario Moretti is a free man right now. And you know, this guy, not me first per se, but a very well-respected journalist in Italy, a British guy, has really pinned him as the guy who pulled the trigger on Mauro, or the most responsible, let's put it that way. So anyway, yeah, so there were some gaps there, because if you look at the theory of terrorism, what it's basically saying is that you have defensive terrorism and you have offensive terrorism, you know, basic strategic categories. And so that if you were going to look at say, for example, defensive terrorism, which is the easiest one to consider, that you have the direct defensive attack. Now, that would be like the terror of the French Revolution. This is where the word terrorism comes from. So they're defending the revolution by using terror against the citizens. So this is a direct defensive attack. And so then, you know, because it is the established power that is using terrorism, you know, against its own citizens. So with the indirect attack, of course, it's this false flag operation. You have the indirect defensive attack. So they're pretending to be someone else, but they're still defending themselves and using it by established power attacking its own citizens. So with offensive terror, you have the direct offensive attack, which would be like the IRA or the PLO if they were not infiltrated. But if we were to consider them, you know, just for the sake of argument, as pure organizations. But now we know, of course, that the IRA and the PLO were getting arms from the West and, you know, Western governments and that kind of thing. Now, and the completely undeveloped category is the indirect offensive attack, which I'm working on now in conjunction with Wayne Methvin in trying to look at that. Of course, all these things are hybrids, and we may not be able to do it, but it looks to us like a lot of these, you know, for example, bombings that are taking place in Iraq, and then they find out that there's some British special forces guys with all these bombs dressed as Arabs and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that, of course, would be indirect offensive attack.
It's a classic perfect bow.
Even 9/11 would have up to that because, you know, if you consider it, it would be offensive from the point of view of say, Israel or Saudi Arabia or Pakistan. If they're you know, forward deployed in the United States, so those are essentially the, you know, the kind of the schema that I use to try to look at this thing, and I do think it could be valuable, and we'll try to develop that a little bit more, because the legacy of the situation is some things are maybe useful, some things may not be useful, but I do think that this particular theory of terrorism, it's one of the elements of this situationist legacy that is actually very useful.
I agree completely. I think it's an understanding of these types of activities is key to a deep parapolitical understanding of human politics. It's, and I think this shenanigans or covert ops or there's so many different words for, you know, false flag terrorism, counterfeit foe, strategy of tension, all these things are just variations on the same theme of dirty tricks, double cross and triple cross. And I want to put state terror 9/11 aside just briefly, and because I want to come back to that, and I want to remind everybody, thank you for tuning in. This is the Blue Rose Report live from anomalyradio.com, and we'd love to hear from you tonight. If you've got a question for our guest Lynn Bracken, you can call us toll free at 800-513-0105. That's 800-513-0105. Or if you've got unlimited long distance or you're in the Central Texas area, give us a call at area code 512-646-4404. Some of the other areas that I wanted to touch on tonight, besides parapolitics, is China, as well as the stranger, darker underbelly of human blackmail activities in the form of the pedophocracy or allegations thereof. And then, of course, I wanted to get into situationism, Guy Debord, culture jamming, and conspiracy culture. So, segueing, and let's just get this out of the way. I at some point I was reading about you, and I said, came across a reference that said that you knew about something about the intentional community known as the Finders. And so when I scroogled for that, I found an interview that was, I guess, conducted by Ken Thomas, an associate of yours, and or yourself, for Steam Shovel Press, that involved interviews with one of the particulars of the center of the the quote-unquote Finders conspiracy, which it's I had never read that interview, and it really gave me a completely different take on what I'd heard. For those that aren't familiar, if you mention the Finders, the first thing that pops into most people's minds is the idea of a van with some dirty children and men in suits in a park, I think in Florida, getting turned in by locals and the cops doing a background search and finding that they, some folks in the D.C. area were like, oh yeah, we know about these guys. And apparently a lot of people in the intelligence community have been curious about this group, this intentional community, for some time. And among a lot of the conspiracy community, there's the general opinion that they're involved in this child sex trafficking, perhaps even ritual satanic abuse, and the kinds of things that a lot of people just blanch at as being just so ridiculous and disproven as social panics and whatnot. And that, while that may be partly true, I am fascinated and disgusted by this kind of sordid conspiracy theory, because I think it is actually a part of the parapolitical scene, and that is, again, blackmail through the oldest tricks in the book, you know, setting people up. And so were you involved in that interview, or can you say?
Oh, no, I can talk about it. If I could just back up a little bit, is it, I met the Finders for the first time in 1982. And he tried to recruit me a little bit, and I did meet this guy, and you know, he was part of them, and he won this contest. We went up to New York, and part of the idea of the Finders is that you should be ready to go in any direction, and you go on these social games, and they'll give you what you want, and you give us a wish list, and you know, some, you know, the idea will be your wishes will be fulfilled, and you know, if you're the least experienced person, you should be put in charge. And they're always doing these kind of weird things. And you know, having lived in D.C. for a long time, I mean, I know a guy that actually lived with them for years. And his circumstance was kind of strange. What he would do is they has a duplex in up just outside of Georgetown, a place called Glover Park, and it was for all the women. But they did, at a certain point, allow some men to live under the house. And you know how houses stick to the foundation that is built on top of dirt? Well, they allowed these guys to dig out trenches and live down under there. And what they were doing is that they would go and they would get, you know, young women at the bus station, and they would bring them to the place. They would feed them, clothe them, give them support, and try to them, how can I put it, strength, for lack of a better expression. And the way they would do it is that they would make them, they would boss the men around. So this is kind of like an example of kind of, you know, kind of feminist training, I guess, you know. And these guys, my friends, were these, you know, rock and roll guys. And, you know, they were like, you know, and then, well, F you and everything. But then they would, you fed potatoes and popcorn, and they were poor, and that's all they could do. You had to live there. So that's one experience. And then, you know, then I you know, went up to New York, and we got caught in this blizzard and sort of lost track of the guy, and you know, he's this musician. He played in, he helped this rock and roll band down the street from my house. He ended up, you know, staying there and teaching guys all the guitar licks. And you know, I never actually went to the different places back in 1980. And so then Ken came down, and he's like, "Wow, let's go and meet the Finders." And there had been a city paper article saying they were in Culpeper. So we drove down there, and we found Mary and Teddy, and that began a much longer relationship that I had with the group. Never as a member per se, but outside the group, and more or less trying to find out, you know, a lot of what they were into, and I met some of the people who had left the group, and this is a key thing I think that people listening to this should find out, that I have it on a couple of good sources that there were never any children that ever said they were molested. There's never one case, and there are people that hate Mary and Petty, that they have ruined their daughter's lives, and they're taking care of the grandchildren that were the result of this group marriage and all that stuff. And they'll cut Mary and Petty up and down, but they will say, you know, that to their knowledge, aside from, you know, some peripheral woman who's a visitor, maybe, you know, just some light touching of a kid, that, and she would be booted out immediately, they never heard of any molestation at all. Now, as far as, you know, the documents that they discovered, maybe some, you know, some adoption things that were going on, I don't know about that. And whether Petty was actually a spy or he was a wannabe spy, I mean, I do think at one point he was a man in black. He carried a gun, dressed in the black dude, and he was a chauffeur for, I think it was an Air Force general. And but then after that, he got out of it and probably wanted to be more in it. His wife evidently worked for the CIA. His son arranged for the Finders to actually teach computers to the CIA. So they had a little computer training operation going. But, it's a funny thing. I mean, was he really CIA or no? I mean, I guess at this point now, I probably would lean that he probably had some kind of relationship with them. I mean, I found out later that he would go on trip with the student advisor at Georgetown University, who probably, can safely assume that those are the kind of people that would be FBI agents. So he had these relationships, but how formal, informal it was, very hard to say. And the other thing is the Finders worked very hard all the time, and so my impression is that they were just kind of working to, like a almost like I hate to use the word cult, because they were cooler than a cult, but in some instances, that's a little bit what it was like, to support the projects of their leader.
Well, from the interview and accompanying data that I found online from the Steam Shovel Press material, it definitely gave me the impression that he obviously was very well connected and was hobnobbing in those circles. He was also hobnobbing in the 60s counterculture circles, from the Timothy Leary types to people in the New Age and parapsychological community, I think. I mean, the interview notes that he was reading Arthur Koestler at the time, but there's also information about him being close friends with Charles E. Marsh, who supposedly ran the best private intelligence network of his era and was an intimate of FDR, Henry Wallace, and later Lyndon Johnson. And I thought it was interesting also that it says Marsh died in December 64. His last known address was Austin, Texas.
Right.
So much strangeness going through this town. But I, yeah, the In the interview, I was surprised again to see the this petty guy mention the provos and situationists in connection to their approach to play and lifestyle and living.
Oh yeah, you would see incredible. They had an incredible library and just fantastic. And they would have this. They bought a medical arts building, and they turned it into a museum for the future. And it was a really cool building. It's one of those that have heat running through the floors, just like a wacky 70s building. Then they had a movie house in the center of Culpeper. And the way they bought it is that they had to get these Koreans to come in and buy these buildings, and then they swapped buildings with the Korean, because nobody in Culpeper would have sold it to Petty. He was so disliked in his hometown. But anyway, they would always use the marquee to put these strange lettering up there, left brain, right brain. I have a photo of one of the guys with the, they would drive, the chauffeur would drive Petty around in a black Cadillac, and then his other duty was to change the words on the marquee to whatever Petty wanted. And of course, they would put their own words up there too. And they were, very fun people. I have to say, we had some great times with them, and they were very supportive of me. They helped me a great deal, like with my computers. And I got a job actually writing student papers, which was very lucrative for me through them. And so, it's hard for me to say anything bad about them, especially when I know that, to the best of my knowledge, that a lot of these pedophile charges against them are false. But I am convinced that the camp stuff and the Franklin and all that is true. So in other words, like it could be that, there could be some real pedophiles out there trying to deflect, the deflect things on them. I mean, in fact, the people that used to be members of the group that I think, as I understand it, they moved out. A lot of them moved out to California. They're still in touch. They don't like Petty, but they're not necessarily divorcing themselves from all of the ideas, and some of it, is fairly compelling things. So I mean, I can't say that I would buy into it. There's a lot of things that I just didn't like about it, and so I couldn't get involved. This whole idea of a group marriage, but then you got the men and the women sleeping in different places,
Yeah,
so I was just one of these kind of guys that could come around, and they would talk to me, and lend me books, and give me connections, and I was sort of on the fringe, but I had a lot of benefits. And I hate to sound opportunistic. I mean, I like to think that I was able to share some things with them as well, But you know, it is the kind of a strange thing, and you know, I haven't seen them for a long time now because you know, it's a messy business. You know, you got people like, I guess that FBI guy, ex-FBI, Ted Gunderson, who's out there saying that they're for sure these
Right.
pedophile ring, you know.
Well, I think a lot of people question his perspective. A lot of it, a lot of people take it for gospel, but there is a good portion of the conspiracy parapolitical community that does take it with a huge chunk of salt. So,
And then, you know, if people are interested in that, they should really subscribe to WayneMasonReport.com because Wayneson has gone to Southeast Asia. He tracked down this whole John Mark Carr business. He's written about it extensively. His theory is that Carr was a procurement guy for the State Department, and this whole JonBenet Ramsey thing was a ruse to get him out of Thailand before the Thai police busted him.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and you know, we did see the charges. Well, it seems like almost every couple of months that more and more of these State Department people are getting arrested for having sex with underage kids. There was just another case recently down in, this guy was in Brazil. So I mean it.
Like that kind of like again, that kind of blackmail seems like it's just so basic and simple. And I mean, there's even elements of that in the Watergate scandal, correct? Not necessarily the pedophile angle, but just the whole, you know, sexual blackmail.
Well, right, and you know, I guess part of the thing was is that they had some kind of list. I forget exactly what it was, but that's part of the reason they were trying to break in there because they thought they had dirt. That was part of the plumber's operation.
Well, let's move away from that talk arena for now, and thank you for sharing that with us. And I know that we're not going to get to cover is in the excruciating detail I'd like tonight in this hour, but all the subjects I want to talk to you about. But we're always you're going to be I know you're going to always be welcome here, so hopefully we can get you back on. But moving on, you've done quite something significant in this first biography in any language of Guy Debord Revolutionary, and the quote on the cover: "Revolution is not showing life to people, but making them live." Guy Debord, critical biography by Lynn Bracken, put out by Feral House Publishing. I've not made it all the way through yet, but I'm finding it very detailed and fascinating explication of something that I know I've been influenced by this movement in modern times by things like classic culture jamming groups ranging from the Billboard Liberation Front to the Cacophony Society and the surveillance camera players or and different these all these different groups that have emerged over the last several decades to deal with consumerism in an artistic expressive way that I really just was unfamiliar with the roots of it. So you mentioned that in growing up you started reading material on revolutionary thought. How quickly did you come into contact with the work of Guy Debord? And I'm sure I'm butchering so many of these foreign
Yeah,
names.
so you're doing fine, and yeah, you know, you mentioned some of these things, and it is funny because you think there's rivalries in the 9/11 truth movement. Boy, you know, you get into this this situationist mosh pit, and everybody's you know, banging head. So, and that's part of the reason why I kind of pulled away from a lot of those polemics because you know it gets kind of messy. And in fact, there's one guy. This is sort of a strange thing, and I don't know how much I should go into it, but one of these guys, Bill Brown from up in New York, you know, I guess he was, you know, he hates my guts, you know, for, I don't know exactly what the reason, but, you know, maybe I've criticized him a little bit here and there, but he did something with the New York Times where he pointed out all these surveillance cameras. And it is kind of a funny thing is that York Times had to print this kind of editorial notice that said that, well, you know, this Bill Brown guy, you know, who pointed out all these things to us. Was evidently arrested for making dirty phone calls to little girls, and he was caught because they had a surveillance camera showing him going into his father's law office where the calls were originated.
Oh my God.
So, well, I guess I got a barb in there, you know. And evidently, you know, there have been some problems with him up in the Rhode Island School of Design as well, up in the in Providence. So, what did it happen? Well, I guess it took me a while. I was When I got the Situationist International Anthology, I was in New York City, And I was working as a salesman, but I was always pulling into libraries and trying to get a little extra reading in and writing I think I wound up at one point as a salesman down in Soho, so I was going into all the galleries. And what we would do is we get the contracts to crate up the art and put special insurance on it and send it all around the world. And I would be kind of like a broker where I would get some deals and do that kind of thing. So I was a real capitalist pig, I guess, there for a while, but I wasn't making that much money. And I got that book, and it was a big influence on me. And I ended up quitting my job, and from there I went up to Cambridge, and I was working with the with Greenpeace as a canvasser, and I guess that was really my big full break. I hadn't really been in the system for that long, maybe about 4 or 5 years after college, and I just I guess then I've held a couple other sales jobs, but tried to get out of that. It's kind of a racket. And anyway, it was a big influence, I would say, ever since the start. You read that opening poem by Shishigloff, and it's just so striking, and it really makes you want to set off for the hacienda, a little bit like the Finders too, I guess. This whole spirit of adventure, because we live such a in such a processed world and these processed lives, that I think everyone knows that there's got to be something better out there. I mean, and we all do experience something better from time to time. It's just then we have to go back to work.
Yeah.
Don't know if that answers your question about the when, and I guess it would have been in 87, right about the time when 86, 87, right about the time when the Finders were arrested, in fact. So a lot of that came together for me back then.
Well, I've been finding a lot of resonance with certain passages in the early the first half of the book on De Boer, and I wanted to read, if I might, two chapters, one, or rather, two paragraphs. The first is your introduction to a quote from De Boer. I found it interesting for some reasons I'll explain. And second, the authors called for extreme simplification in the use of diversions for immediate recognition and effect on memory. However, the diverted phrase shouldn't just be a rational response to an existing slogan, as with L'Autrement, because this approach can be confused with a banal repartee. It's more powerful, the authors advise, to transform the pre-existing element by a reversal of values effected by the quick addition of a new title, or interchanging titles, or, for example, by holding a black mass in a famous church. This was the, quote, real means of proletarian artistic teaching, the first outline of literary communism. And then the quote from De Boer, I believe, is, to finish, we must briefly cite a few aspects of what we call ultra diversions, that is, types of diversions applied to everyday social life. Gestures and words can be charged with another meaning, and have been throughout history for practical reasons. The secret societies of ancient China possessed great refinement in recognizing each other, encompassing most mundane attitudes, how to use cups, to drink, to cut citations of poems at agreed-upon points. The need for a secret language, passwords, is inseparable from a tendency to play. The idea is that any sign, any word, is prone to being converted into something else, even its opposite. Now, the idea of the Blue Rose Report, the name comes from David Lynch's prequel to the Twin Peaks television series, the prequel called Fire Walk With Me. And there's a sequence where an FBI agent played by David Lynch, he gives a weird theatrical experience to his underlings to convey information. And it's this woman dancing around and doing all these signs, gestures, and contortions, and everything about her dress and her gestures and her mannerisms is a code. And certainly there's in the parapolitical conspiracy community, there's a lot of focus in some circles on occult symbolisms, and in some circles they call it twilight language and the revelation of the method, the revealing of all that's been hidden, all the secret shenanigans of these secret societies becoming blatant out in the open. And I don't know, that was kind of like the last thing I was expecting to find in this book was that quote. And I may be completely misapplying and taking it in a completely different direction than it was originally intended, but this idea of play, which, being a Terrence McKenna fan, one of my favorite quotes of his is that the idea of mind as play
and like a quintessence of human experience. That seems to be at the heart of De Boer. And yet it's that prankishness of situationism and in some of its more modern forms in Discordianism that has seemed to have infiltrated these activist groups and formed these activist groups in ways that I at once find concerning and at the same time find liberating and exciting. So I don't know if there's a question.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me at this point, it just, especially after 9/11, because, you know, 9/11 just took the wind out of the sails of this anti-globalization movement, because we realized that that's how powerful the state is, and just, you know, anything that we do could be seen as provocation. You know, I remember when they had the inauguration of Bush, and we all got cornered, and then some guy, you know, just looks like your typical, you know, crusty anarchist guy, says, "Hey, you know, I got a knife. Why don't you go and pop that tire?" You know, and here, look, you know, look what we've done. We've taken like stickers and, you know, like labels, you know, and we've written all kinds of stuff, and you can have some and you can paste them places, you know. So even, and I think back on it, you know, it's like, hey, you know, you want to pop that tire, you pop the tire, you're gonna get me busted, you know. And so at this point, you know, I think a lot of the play in that may have been taken out of it. I mean, I think you can do it by surprise. I think you can walk around like with a magic marker, you can rewrite the whole world. I mean, and you know, I've done that. I don't know if you've seen the city article to me, and you know, we've done a lot of this kind of thing, and I would say that my best writing I've ever done has been by graffiti. But, you know, at this point it's just so difficult because the power of the state is so strong, and we find ourselves in what Sun Tzu called did a pure war, where any resistance wouldn't extreme sacrifice. So, you know, I get to, you know, as you're down there in Austin, Texas, and, you know, I don't know how you feel about Alex Jones. I get a big kick out of him. And there he was, you know, with this Michelle Malkin thing. I don't know if necessarily, you know, it's not the kind of thing I would do. But then they had some guy behind him who's saying, kill Malkin, you know. And it, you know, shown to be that these, you know, at least that's what, you know, Jones is saying, is that these are probably, you know, pigs. And so, you know, you try to have some kind of, the point is, all the tactics can be, anything that's tactical can be taken and used against you. So it is everything's a double-edged sword.
Well, yeah, being here in Austin, I'm well aware of Alex, and I'm a big fan, and I tend to be an apologist for him in some forums. And I'm, you know, I think he's human like everybody else. He's got big foible character flaws, but I think he's generally doing a good thing. And yeah, I have mixed feelings about his approach, this popularization of what some have called ambush journalism, but which is more like just confrontational provocation and propositioning. And actually that kind of gets again to this idea that I see over and over in De Boer of, you know, really just slinging stones, so to speak, at certain public figures, especially people of much repute in the art world. And I found in his identification with this person, Cardinal de Retz or Gondi, and I'm probably getting all the names.
Oh, right.
And this idea of the Fronde.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this really interesting, and it at once, this whole tendency towards confronting these figures and trying to basically shout them down, but through like witty repartee, you know, that really strikes me as pretty interesting and applicable in all these circumstances. Another bit here is a strange bedfellows, but there's a bit of false flag, use of false flag type tactics here by this Gondi character, where in your book here it says, "Then there were Gondi's ability to stage events, to take the high ground. In a sublime example of political theater, Gondi staged an attack on a lesser magistrate using prearranged gunfire. The latter cut himself to get his allies to come to his assistance against Mazarin's henchmen, who were said to be murdering the Frondeurs. Retz was the best example of the sense of drama and insolence that animated the Baroque world. De Boer undoubtedly also admired Gondi's political cultural consciousness that treated his enemies with elegant scorn."
That's the thing too, is that you know, the idea that you can have a really big impact with some small event, with some, you know, location, with some gesture, and the situation really master that. And I guess I would like to think that it could still be possible that you could show the culpa with the board talked about that, you know, you're laughing at it and feel the worldly laughing at it. But it seems to me that the powers are so big and the odds are so against you that, you know, I hate talk, you know, in such, you know, negative terms, but I don't see the way out. The only way is that if things get really bad, then, you know, we'll all turn into these, you know, modern day hobos with the sacks of vegetables over our backs and wearing these kind of identifiable hobo clothes, the way the Flaneurs were identified by their, you know, by their clothing, and maybe something could be possible that way, you know, would keep all the really rich people behind their 18-foot-high wall, and, you know, maybe there would be some chance for community, for assembly, for democracy and unity, and then all of the good things, you know, that I think that, you know, most people would like to see happen in the world. But, you know, there's this whole idea now of, in the situation, is the false consciousness, you know, and comes from Marx. And it doesn't mean exactly what you would think it would mean just on the basis of the words. What it really means is that if you have a critique, you have to build into your critique a you know, a sort of a revolutionary solution for the problem, you know, that you've exposed. And that's where, at this point, you know, I think we're all grappling, you know, is it going to be anarchist affinity groups? Is it going to be, you know, community councils or, you know, worker councils? You know, what could it possibly be? There's some kind of a reform of a, you know, legislative democracy. You know, in the end, these guys were very sophisticated kind of political scientists, sociologists, and you know, it really was amazing what they were able to do, particularly with these, you know, some of their tracks. You know, particularly the student publications that they had that really inspired the student revolt in May 1968, and then their posters and their contacts with the workers that sort of, you know, helped escalate the thing into a nationwide general strike. But I get, you know, and then, you know, you get in the idea that, okay, so any little critique that we have, you know, we have to think, okay, what is the transformative aspect of it? And not just in a personal basis, but in a collective basis and in terms of world history. And I think that was another really valuable aspect of the situation is thinking about how you can kind of impose yourself or your group on history itself. But for me, you know, at this point, you know, the odds are so stacked against us that all I can think to do with history is use it as kind of a raw material for art and, you know, and for events and look to see if there's going to be a crack or an opening, because, you know, I don't consider myself to be a revolutionary at this point because I don't see the prospects for revolution.
Yeah, I'd like to be a little more optimistic myself, but yeah, the situation does seem pretty dire. And not right yet, but it's in some ways it seems like more and more people are waking up and that it's getting just about time. But speaking of time, we're closing in on the top of the hour, and I'm not sure if you can stay past the top of the hour or not, but would that be possible to say?
Yeah, we can go on for a little bit more, you know, just if you know, we run out of gas in a little bit, then you know, a few more minutes after it's fine.
Well, why don't we take a break and give ourselves a chance to go away from the microphone for just a few moments, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes or so. Will that
be the yes.
Okay. Here we go, folks. This is Blue Rose Report live via Anomaly Radio. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back with our guest, Lynn Brackett.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. This is Miles Lewis live via Anomaly Radio. You're listening to the Blue Rose Report, and we're just going to go a little bit longer here with our guest, Lynn Bracken, the author of The Shadow Government, 9/11, and State Terror, as well as the biography of French Situationist Guy Debord, Revolutionary. And we've been talking about subjects as diverse as 9/11, intentional communities that have bad reputations like the Finders, and as well as a situation as Guy Debord. So, and I hope to get to China, because you wrote a really great travelogue of sorts called The New China Syndrome, with amazing series of photographs, and I definitely want to get to that in just a second. But let's stick to 9/11 if we can. Lynn, you still there?
Yeah, sure.
Great. Some of the things that you delve into in the 9/11 book are really still very much staples of the 9/11 truth movement, and yet there definitely seem to be a lot of different flavors of quote-unquote 9/11 truth, and some of them seem less grounded in the strategic parapolitical deep politics appreciation of covert ops like 9/11. But you cover things like the wiring of $100,000 to Mohammed Atta from the head of ISI, Pakistani intelligence, and the put options that seem to be tied to people like Buzzy Krongard, former dude with the CIA, and you touch on a lot of really good, important things there. And I noticed that there's nothing in there, at least so far that I've read, about the idea of CD, the controlled demolition meme that seems to be so much the mainstay of so many 9/11 truthers. And I've heard in other interviews with you where you pretty much, you have a lot to say about the two very important and infamous French books on the subject of 9/11. Would you care to elaborate on either of those, or there's some that I haven't mentioned that you think are more important from the book?
Yeah, you're thinking of the other interview. Well, you know, I guess, you know, it's a little far afield for me right now. I mean, those guys, you know, the French book, and, you know, you think that maybe this guy, Mason, was sort of, you know, set up to write the book and then shot down. And you know, I don't know if it's worth going into all that. You know, of course, he wrote the first book, and he made a lot of money on it, but, you know, probably that particular theory might not hold up. Who knows, over time, he might be proven correct. I mean, you know, it seems unlikely. But where do we stand now? You know, I'm almost willing to entertain any possibility. You know, I've spoken with Judy Wood. I did an interview with her and wrote up, you know, sort of her theory for Paranoia Magazine last year. And I've traveled to Weehawken with Wayne Madsen, who did, I think, probably one of the best expose of the art students. And in case your listeners don't know, in Weehawken was the home base of Urban Moving Systems, which was a massive crime. And I've followed very closely Hopsicker. I did a review of Hopsicker's book, and I would volunteer for 9/11 Citizens Watch, not so much working, you know, a part of them, but just volunteered a little bit here and there. And they brought Hopsicker to deep at a press conference with him. And I think that he did great work of exposing a little bit who Mohammed Atta is, mm-hmm. and his research down in Venice Beach, Florida. But I guess when it comes to just how these buildings came down and the missiles and all these other things, it's like, and the possibility that there were, you know, beams and you know, shot from space or from trucks, or and maybe that there were not even any planes. I mean, I tell you, I've seen that the one feed that came through, and you know, some of these, the people that are putting these things are anonymous, so, you know, I have to take it with a grain of salt, but that second plane going into the building, I mean, when you look and see how they've cropped it, and you get some people that are really good at analyzing video, and, you know, could be convincing. It's hard to say. So yeah, there's all those flavors of 9/11 truth, like you say. At this point, I'm almost willing to keep my mind open to any possibility. And,
well, you know, there's definitely certain schools of thought in this emerging new community, this outgrowth of the parapolitical conspiracy community. And like in any field of study that deals with anomalies, there tends to be a cliquishness that resists anything outside of itself that seems at all unlikely or ridiculous by those people's standards. And I mean, in me being somebody who studies various aspects of the paranormal from an anomalous perspective and a Fortean perspective, you know, I try to be agnostic about it all, and it all intrigues me. So I go all very far afield from, you know, the study of the mind to the study of parapolitics. But it seems like in the 9/11 truth movement, there's been some pretty significant schisms, and one of them seems to be over this the space beams idea, the energy weapons idea. And yeah, that I've been asked repeatedly to confront you about the space beams article that you did for Paranoia, and it's one of those things. It's like when I first heard that you did it, I was like, wow, that seems like the least likely thing I would ever expect you to report on, even though you'd already taken the risk of writing something on 9/11 as being an inside job early on. And yet when I read your treatment of it, it seemed, you know, rational and balanced. And I don't, again, I try to be as open-minded as you're describing yourself. So, how do you respond to that, to any criticism that you might get over, you know, being so open-minded that your brains are spilling out into this arena of space speaking?
Right. Well, if you look at well, you know, we did go up to ground zero, and we've talked to FEMA people who said the cars were fused. They said that they thought that there were maybe tactical nukes that were used there. You know, they had the high levels of radiation. And then with Judy Wood, when, you know, I talked to her, and she says that, hey, they, you know, the same companies that produced these weapons were assigned to do the NIST report on how the buildings came down. And, you know, they've got all this business about how they can just, you know, vaporize buildings on their websites. I mean, and, you know, here she is, she's a PhD, and you know, it could be that one of her students was killed under, you know, sort of strange circumstances. I mean, she could be the person who's really in a position to know about this stuff. And just like, say, with the Kennedy assassination, I mean, it could very well be that there were explosives in the buildings and there were beams. I mean, it might not be that it's all mutually exclusive. It could be that they did, you know, did both, the, you know, the and both thesis. And, you know, when she pointed out to me these sort of pile driver cylindrical holes from the shots, you know, the aerial shots of the buildings, and you know, it just looks as if there was something that carved these things out, and it doesn't look like the rubble would correspond with how much there would be there if these things had just collapsed and not been sort of dustified, as she says. And, you know, I guess at this point, you know, I don't want to sort of go on the record as sort of characterizing her thing. I probably did it a little more carefully in the article, and, you know, she's in the middle of a lot of conflicts, and I don't really want to insert myself in any of that stuff at this point.
Sure.
Except to say that I respect her and her work, and you know, Jones, you know, maybe he's right, but and maybe there was also some thermite, you know, maybe not. Yeah. So, you know, I do think that part of the reason that the powers that be are so confident is because they do have these crazy weapons, and you know, like they might think, hey, we can go into Iran. Nobody thinks we can do it, but, you know, we've got the base weapons, and you know, we could break those out if we had to.
Well, again, there's that aspect of the conspiracy community that's reported on for decades, various technologies that seem to be, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 plus years ahead of what's publicly known, whether it's stealth technology or non-lethal technology or alleged mind control technology. It's hard to know. I mean, you can see patents for things that are public record, and again, applying just a rough, you know, oh, they're probably a decade ahead of what we know about. That seems likely. And like you say, on their own websites, there's this information about the potential uses for these space-based weapons or other high-energy oriented weapons, the effects that they could have that seem to mimic some of the stuff reported there. It just conjures up one more level of just complexity that for the average person just seems so outrageous and unlikely. Even, you know, at the same time, here we are talking about 9/11 conspiracies other than the acknowledged Bush administration's version of events. That in and of itself is enough for most people to just, you know, your average people to just kind of go write you off. Something that's been suggested, though, that keeps coming up, and This gets around to my admission to you about one of the reasons I decided to finally broach communication. It was at some point I started hearing people suggest the idea that some people in the conspiracy community were basically Discordians, culture jammers, and dare I say, situationists, and that part of some of the wackier elements of the 9/11 truth movement may in fact be folks along these lines. And for example, a friend of mine who's frequently interviewed Greg Palast asked Greg straight up, you know, you're friends with Thier Meisson or however you pronounce his name. What is it with him and this whole Pentagon, you know, 9/11 missile theory? And the answer that he got was more or less that Meisson is basically a performance artist or a sort of a culture jammer, and that he wasn't above, you know, getting dollars from American idiots who wanted to buy his book. I don't know if any of that is an accurate characterization, but in other circles, I started noticing some strange bedfellows. I mean, there's this character Nico Haupt, who I came across first in like 2003 on message boards for 9/11, who seemed to just have some amazing data, just was just pouring out lots and lots of information. But over the last several years has completely changed, and that's my perception from afar, never having met the fellow, but he's transformed into this very confrontational person who's espousing these TV fakery, hologram, no planes idea, and generally acting kind of in a situationist. I don't know if that's an accurate projection of mine, but and another weird.
Well, if I could I just talk about the two real quickly.
Absolutely.
Meisson, evidently, you know, I've talked to people in Paris who said that he was actually doing some fairly good work in looking into the right wing. And then that's how he was cultivated by the intelligence agencies unbeknownst to him. And then in terms of the 9/11 book, you know, maybe Palat has the right characterization. I don't know the guy. But and you know, maybe it was just sort of opportunism, and I'd hate to think that, because this is not the kind of thing that you want to, you know, kid around about. I mean, you know, the victims' families and a lot of, you know, a lot of emotions are all wrapped up in this 9/11 business, and that's part of the reason why I don't do very many radio shows, and I don't make, you know, I didn't make hardly any money on this thing, and that was not my goal at all, just to try to get to the truth a little bit. And then as far as the Nico Haupt guy, you know, I saw him up in Cooper's Union a few years ago, and I guess he seems to have a little bit of the, oh, what's the word, not situationist so much as a, gosh, I had the name on the tip of my tongue, it's, what's like the Jerry, the Yippies, he's kind of like an old Yippie, he seems to me, you know, and he's an old guy, and he seems to come to the kind of a Yippie movement, which was a very strong, of course, in New York. He is a New York guy, right? Isn't he?
That's my understanding thereabouts.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so people have strong feelings, and I don't want to, you know, sort of cast aspersions on anybody about that. You know, my thing is that if you can't relate to what they say, you know, you just move on best you can, you know. And of course, if they're going to be in your face about it, then, you know, you move on quickly. But who were you going to say a third person? You were going to give another example.
Well, and this one is harder to confirm, but apparently there was a online marketing guru, I believe named Marcus Allen, and at some point he had like a really big email distribution list of people that he would email his newsletter, daily ideas for how to, you know, make money, kind of a thing. And at some point he completely dropped out, and I don't know how much of this is myth and if this is even really the same guy, but this person dropped out and said, sayonara, you know, I'm not doing this anymore. And then crops up in the 9/11 truth conspiracy community all over message boards posting about no plane theories. And that just seemed really like a weird, wild, crazy change. And apparently trying to do it on the down low, you know, trying not to be Marcus Allen and using screen names. And then when he would be called out, suddenly he would stop posting. But the strange thing was, one of the things he would post about, like this one alternative 9/11 theorist, Fenton Dunn, at his website, Break for News,
this Marcus Allen character started posting No Plane stuff, and but he started accusing Fenton of working for SCI.cc. And if you go to that website, SCI.cc, it's a company that specializes in legal psyops, legal psychological warfare. It literally gives examples of how, you know, they want to work for the government, you know. So if there's like a toxic spill or a biochemical terror attack, that they can massage the media and put out the disinformation to keep people in their homes to protect them, but by lying to them. And so it's like, here's this guy who's espousing something that most people just think is the worst of the worst of 9/11 conspiracy theories, and yet he is calling attention to something really important. Organizations like this that would basically be doing the kind of, you know, the classic culture jamming by corporations on us, the classic, you know, manipulation of the masses and mind control in that sense.
Wow, that is really something. I'd never heard that before. I'll have to look into it. And then, you know, I have my resistance to the no-plane theory as well. I mean, in my paranoia piece, I just said, you know, hey, look, I referred you to Judy Wood, and I don't know if she says no-plane or what plane, you know, exactly her argument at this point, I can't quite remember. But the thing that I saw quite recently, which was posted on Madsen's discussion board, and it came from a guy who was obviously a real expert in looking at these videos, he says that Fox provided the main feed to all of the different channels. And then on the morning of 9/11, it was really pretty much one shot showed that second plane going in there. And then it was very, clumsily edited to the point that anybody could spit. And then he actually managed to go into Fox and get a copy of the original, which was said to no longer exist, but he did find it. You can see the plane to sort of flying by behind the building. You see, so in other words, you know, the plane looks like it's going to hit, a bomb goes off, but the plane actually flipped right on by from behind.
And that mimics some people's ideas about what happened at the Pentagon, the idea that, you know, the supposed hijacked plane flew over and was, you know, there was a sleight of hand trick with either a cruise missile or a smaller plane that actually hit the Pentagon, and the other one flew on and landed, and God knows what happened to it. But
yeah, that's a tough one. Yeah, I just they had on C-SPAN this guy talking about his book, where a couple of guys did this book interviewed for responders, and the first responders went around one by one, and they all, you know, sort of joked, said, yes, of course, the plane hit the Pentagon, and the plane inside the Pentagon, and then working with Judd, I read after the day probably about 30 pages of more or less eyewitness accounts, of many eyewitness accounts saying that the plane did hit the Pentagon. Some of them actually, you know, I guess, but the people really see it actually go in.
Yeah.
That's the thing, you know. So, you know, it was by one of those beams right before it hit, and then the beam went in. That's another possibility.
There's a new one on me. Well, I respect John Judge, and I videotaped him and several other people, Dick Gregory and Bob Roden and John Judge's assistant, who uses the pseudonym T. Carter, who is supposed to be on one of those flights, the one that supposedly went into the Pentagon that day. And I've got videotape of her. And for so long, people have claimed that she didn't even exist. And I'm like, well, whether you doubt her story or not, she, a person exists. That's the one that Judge is always referring to. Here's my videotape of her. I've put that on YouTube. And, you know, there's just so much there, as several people have said, it's an orgy of evidence. I mean, there's so much there. And that's another area that I wanted to ask you about, this idea that, you know, if some nefarious group has planned this, whether it's the alleged hijackers or some other handlers, have been planning this since at least 97 with Bojinka, but even earlier, then there's some other alleged witnesses and whistleblowers out there that have even wilder stories. But this idea of planes as weapons, and this kind of a scenario, if they were planning this, you know, for so long, they'd also be planning the aftermath. And that's something that researchers like Fenton Dunn have stressed that I like. And that's that the planning entailed necessarily the creation of a 9/11 truth movement, because, you know, knowing, you know, we're in this internet age, and that you're going to have to, you know, there's going to be more, you know, people ready to pounce on all this stuff. And so you've got to build in false leads, perhaps. And there's a whole school of thought that a lot of the elements in the 9/11 truth movement are just that. They're the things that were the trail that was left deliberately so that, you know, once the fervor for 9/11 reinvestigation emerged, that a lot of the mainstays of the conspiracy community can be knocked down easily, or can be executed as what they call limited hangout. What do you
think? Right. No, I think that's a very good point. Valid point. And of course, the big elephant is all this evidence against the Israelis and their involvement. And that's one thing that only now is starting to really come out, I think. Another thing that was posted on Madsen's site was, it was some video, and they had the audio in there of some of these police calls, and these guys saying, hey, we found this van in there that's got a mural on the side of it of planes crashing into the buildings, and, you know, we'll get those guys and beat them up, you know. And you can hear them saying that. And one of these things, I mean, geez, here we are, 2008, and I've never even heard of that until now.
Well, I'd say that one's floated around a couple of times, and I've actually heard something, what I thought sounded at the time, a fairly good debunking of it, that it actually was actually from a year later. But then there's the whole thing about the bombs on the Washington Bridge, or the vehicle that was stopped. And now you mentioned the Israeli angle, and I, you know, this is something I think is really important, I think, to this understanding of it. And there's so many different possibilities, but again, this is, it's maybe one of those built-in things that's easily, like, you know, how many times have you heard, you know, 9/11 truthers described, or even average conspiracy theorists described, as anti-Semitic, just because they, you know, talk about the Israeli Mossad, or just because they, you know, use the phrase international banker, you know. It's almost like a built-in straw man. I mean, it's certainly, I know people who don't buy into the more conspiracy theory 9/11 inside job idea, but they think that the Mossad may have been farmed out by other American intelligence agencies to track these guys, and I think that there's quite likely the possibility of sting operations, or the presumption of a sting operation that some people thought they were involved in, when in fact it was going operational.
Yeah, I do think that you have to look at urban moving systems. You have to look at Weehawken. And what Madsen was able to find out, and it, not the trip that I went with him, but his previous trip, he went up there and he got in the bar. He started talking to these cops, and they started bringing out the Bergen record stories, and then what emerged was, he got this on multiple sources, was that the 9/11, they cordoned off that whole place, and they brought in FBI guys with moon suits, and they found anthrax in the urban moving system. They found bombs. They found all kinds of stuff in there. So, you know, I mean, it could very well be that the anthrax came from Fort Detrick, but, you know, it was mailed out of Jersey. And, yeah, this guy who was the head of that urban moving systems, it reportedly has been communicated to 9/11 truth people that he's back in the country now. And you know, Comverse Info Systems just gave it port security at the Port of Houston. We just tapped at the assassination of CIA agent Carnaby down there in Houston, and he was looking into a lot of this stuff. He dies, and then Comverse Info Systems gets port security for Houston. And he was actually worried that there was going to be an attack either on 4th of July or Memorial Day weekend in Houston. He was saying that Carnaby was saying that that's where the next attack would be. Now, of course, you know, you say the dates, and the dates pass, and you know, you know everybody, you know, says, oh, look at you, you're a fool. But it doesn't mean that's wrong to think that particular place is vulnerable.
Indeed.
So that the real thing about it is, okay, you know, call anybody, anything you want, but what if we are under attack? You know, we could be under attack from very close ally. You know, the thing, you know, it's just indubitable, and no one will sort of acknowledge it. The Washington Times had that report. On they had an article on a report from the War College saying that you know, the Israelis are a loose cannon and could attack us and make it look as if the Arabs had done it, and that was published on the September 10th, the day before it happened.
I need to find a copy of that, because I only recently heard reference to that, and again, I saw it, read it again in your book, and that I need to find a print copy of that. I think I'll go down to my public library and finally dig that out, because yeah, that blows my mind. I mean, there's
that's strategic analysis. That's not conspiracy theory.
Right. Well, and that's just it. So much of the convincing stuff for me is just the foreknowledge stuff, because foreknowledge is fairly verifiable. There's usually some sort of documentation that can verify, you know, somebody being warned about something, and that seems like a pretty obvious warning to me. But we've kept you 30 minutes past the end of the normal end of the show, Lynn, and I wanted to go ahead and end out the show for now, but invite you back. I know, like I said, that there's still areas I wanted to touch on that we hadn't gotten to, like China, and I could endlessly come up with questions to pose to you about your take on parapolitics and 9/11. So any final words or comments? We should send people, of course, to your website, lynnbracken.com.
Right. Might maybe down right now, but the guys are changing the server over. I guess, you know, the one thing, if we could just stay on this one last point for one more minute, and I think that if I can remember the sequence of what happened, was the New York Post came out in the summer of 2002, and they had this big cover story. It said, Bush knew. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, Bush said, in Israel, you could have told us more, and maybe they knew more about it than we, and the Israelis called his bluff, and they invited in a bunch of journalists, mostly foreign journalists, and they showed them, wouldn't let them take out the documents, but they showed them everything that had been shown to the United States, and they came out and they said that, you know, hey, you know, they were, the United States was forewarned. And the other thing that I would say is that they, you know, and I have this from John, who said, you know, I've got to, my name, the journalist, but Newsweek published that thing saying that the Pentagon officials were told on the 10th, don't fly on the 11th, all the big time brass. And then when they confronted the guy, you know, I'm not going to say his name because I can't remember quite. He says, oh, I never wrote that. And then he says, well, if I wrote that, I was wrong. So then they went to one of the co-authors of the thing. And he says, well, yeah, we the Pentagon definitely told it that, and we wrote it and we're standing by it. So you got even journalists that they're trying to weasel out of their words, that, you know, when they've got the Pentagon admitting that, you know, they had canceled all trips on their, you know, the day before.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I'm sorry. Yeah, we could go on and on. I'm sorry.
No,
very,
thank you.
Very passionate topic. So
I'm glad to hear your passion. And like I said, I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I would love to have you back on again very soon. Anytime you've got anything you want to cover, you've got a venue here at Anomaly Radio and the Blue Ridge Report. And folks, you can find out more about Lynn Bracken at the website lynnbracken.com. He's the author of The Shadow Government, 9/11 and State Terror, as well as Guy Debord, Revolutionary, as well as several nonfiction and fiction books, Snitch Jacket and some others. Thanks for tuning in, and Lynn, I'll talk to you on the other side, okay?
Thanks.
Take care.